Good evening, this is Mae Brussel. The title of this one-hour broadcast is World Watchers. It's program number 797, March the 17th, 1987. The co-owner of the Monterey Herald, our only newspaper here in the Monterey, Carmel, Pacific Grove area, Paul Block, died yesterday at Community Hospital. He was co-publisher of The Blade, the Toledo newspaper in Ohio, and the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Along with his brother, they were in the publishing business. He also was a scientist, a chemist, who got a degree in chemistry from Columbia University and advanced studies at Yale, and had a very interesting background that most of us are deprived of knowing until somebody passes away. We learn about the things that they did and their interests and their accomplishments in the obituary, unfortunately, and people like this who are very private people don't reveal much of themselves and lead a very quiet life. He spent time between here and Ohio and lived at Pebble Beach. Several years ago, quite a few years ago, Mr. Block's secretary called me and said that he and his wife would like me to come over to the house. They were having a cocktail party or a gathering of some kind. And I said that I was not interested in attending. I appreciate the invitation, but I don't go to parties where there's more than 10 people, and I know this would be that kind of a gathering, and I'm really not interested. And so they called me back and said they were interested in having me over, that I was important in the community and that he would like to meet me, and they were just having this small gathering. So I went to his home and enjoyed myself and spent time there and then came home. About 2 years later, the San Francisco Chronicle had an article by Jack Anderson on Project Paperclip, and the Monterey Herald carries the same Jack Anderson column during the weekdays that the San Francisco one does, but it's a bit longer. The San Francisco edits out some important information. They select which paragraphs they keep out. The Chronicle has a long Jack Anderson during the weekdays, and I called the Monterey Herald and said that I would like them to print the column that San Francisco had on Project Paperclip, because the few years before, I had given two semesters of college credit classes on political assassinations, and Project Paperclip was number one on the list of books to read if you want to understand political assassinations and coup d'etat and what is happening to this country. And Project Paperclip is timely today, of course. So the manager of the Herald, the local area here, said that he wouldn't print it, that they had scheduled for other days, whatever came in those days, and that this was over and it wouldn't be printed. So I picked up the telephone and called Mr. Block in Ohio, in Toledo, Ohio, and he was very, very understanding. And as I look at the bio of his background, I understand more why he was so cooperative. And he said, well, I'll tell you what I'll do. I'll put a direct line into Jack Anderson. He sends in 7 articles a week, and we choose which ones out of the 5 days, but I'll have it in Saturday and Sunday, and you'll get 7 days continuously, which is more probably than any other newspaper in the United States. And he did it quickly. He said, you'll have your Project Paperclip article on Tuesday, and from then on, you'll have 7 days to choose or to study whatever it is you want to see. Now, about 3 months ago, they took the Saturday Jack Anderson out, and I was wondering if they were going to do the Sunday again, and I would call Ohio. They changed the Saturday format. But this was a person who moved very quickly, who was intelligent about what I was trying to say and why I thought it mattered. And then reading about his life, one of the things that they called attention to in the Monterey Herald today was his interest in defending Dr. Robert Oppenheimer at the time he was accused of having some friends who might have been in the Communist Party, that he was a staunch editorial defender of Oppenheimer, that he wrote papers on the fetish of atomic secrecy, that we should share information, and he was concerned with a great deal of things out there besides just running newspapers or just his scientific expertise, of which he was supposed to hold certain, he was the sole source of certain synthetic analogs for thyroid hormones that he had developed and synthesized that helped respiratory distress and so forth. He was very active in medicine with medical groups, societies, and in scientific work, but he showed enough interest in my particular project to be as cooperative as he could, and I appreciated that always. And sometimes people ask me, particularly on the talk show part of my program, who do you like? Who are your heroes? And last week I was sharing with them some of the people that I've admired through the years. But there are a lot of people whose lives have crossed, or mine, or I've crossed through theirs, in some way or contact that made a difference in my state of mind, that doors aren't closed, you aren't rejected, that people out there can help you, even people from Fortune 500, such as the Blocks, can help you. And so I feel that I'm fortunate to meet some of these people, and then in turn they do something very useful in terms of just like printing those materials, which I share with you many times on the article, Jack Anderson, on the program, Jack Anderson, stories that you wouldn't get from any other newspaper. So I just wanted to pass this little bit on to you about Project Paperclip. I haven't mentioned the TV movie that was on about a month ago. I don't know how many of you get public broadcasting or saw the movie. It was a very interesting one-hour documentary on Project Paperclip. There was one a few years ago. This was even more interesting. And the interesting thing about this, there were three points that I noticed in this presentation at this time. One was that when the V-2 rockets were built that were a bomb in Great Britain, Walter Dornberger used Wernher von Braun, who was only 22 years old at the time, and they were all high risks to come to the United States. The book Project Paperclip explains that. The loyalty was questioned, whether they would have their allegiance to Adolf Hitler and the Third Reich, but they were brought here anyway. The second point that was interesting in this movie was that Heinrich Himmler was the man who separated the space weapons from the general weapons system in Nazi Germany. And when the Project Paperclip scientists came here, the atomic scientists and NASA separated themselves from the regular Defense Department or the Air Force or Navy. They were their own agency, NASA, with headquarters in Muscle Shoals, Alabama, and Huntsville, Alabama. That area came into prominence at the time the Challenger was ordered to go up and then went down within 4 minutes. And they became their own private agency. And Heinrich Himmler was the gentleman working through SS Carl Wolf with Alan Dulles of the OSS, making arrangements for after the war to transfer the paperclip scientists to the United States. Their war horrors and their mass labor, slave labor, and murders associated with the death camps where they worked them to death at Dora and Peenemünde. The separation of these people from the regular military gave them their own elite clique and kept them working by themselves. And Himmler, whose idea was to separate it, was very close to the Americans who were to bring these people over to the United States. And then finally, one of the most important parts of this movie, it explains how President Truman said, don't bring war criminals into the United States. But it didn't matter what the president said. The powers that be, such as William Donovan or William Alan Dulles of the OSS, and William Casey was in the OSS, but Donovan and Dulles had the primary say in those days. They could bring these Nazi criminals, knowing they were here, knowing they were criminals, into the United States. And as soon as Reinhard Gehlen, the chief of Hitler's intelligence of the East, left the United States and went back to Germany after he formed our CIA, he went back to Germany and was head of the BND, the German intelligence. And then he proceeded to go through all the war records and erase the files and all sources of information about the paperclip persons who were here, all their criminal war behavior, and their names were erased. So I wonder, when I see the picture of the docket with Fritz Kramer, number 33 in the docket, with Sepp Dietrich and Hermann Preiss and his gang of cohorts from the Malmedy massacre, when Kramer's name appears in no history books after World War II in any way, shape, or form, he had to be erased along with the Gehlen operation of erasing the names of people who were criminals, because Adolf Hitler's criminal, the Fritz Kramer, has never been seen or identified, but later, within a short time period, 1948, he's working with the same people in our Defense Department and in the Pentagon with the State Department also, that are working with the other Nazis. And it's hard to believe that the Fritz Kramer that starts working for the federal government in 1948 is different than the Fritz Kramer who was released by Senator Joe McCarthy in 1948 out of the Dachau prison. In reading the Webster's military biography of Albert Wiedemeyer, and I've shared this with you before, he's the general that Ronald Reagan gave a Medal of Freedom not too long ago. Wiedemeyer trained at West Point, went to Texas for some more work, went to China, the Philippines, spent 2 years in the Philippines, worked with the General Staff School at Fort Leavenworth, Kansas. Then he was attached to the Intelligence Division of the General Staff and attended the Kriegsakademie of Adolf Hitler, the military school in Berlin, from 1938 to 1940. He was the first American since World War I to attend the German military school. He joined Eisenhower. He was an aide to General Marshall. He was a chief of staff to Chiang Kai-shek. He was the leader of the Kuomintang at the time. And Chiang formed the World Anti-Communist League. And out of that milieu, they created Reverend Moon with Ryosho Sasakawa's help and were influential in Japan, South Korea, and Taiwan. So the history of Wiedemeyer goes from his early days in the military to Germany, then in Asia, and with these organizations that are headed, like World Anti-Communist League, by John Singlaub. The Contragate story and the Irangate story ties directly to the activities and locations of people like Wiedemeyer, who are honored by the President of the United States and who attended the Kriegsakademie. Now, in the book The Crossroads of Death, the story of the Malmedy Massacre, it's written by James Weingartner. He says that Fritz Kramer, the man who served time in the docket for the Malmedy Massacre, has a background which is described in quotes as not available. Information on his early years are not available, but he has served in the Berlin Municipal Police at the time that Wiedemeyer could have been in Germany, 1930. He went to Germany and was at the Kriegsakademie from 38 to 40. Kramer was in Berlin, and he attended the Kriegsakademie 1934 to 35. So that just 3 years before Wiedemeyer joins the Kriegsakademie of Adolf Hitler, Fritz Kramer was there for 3 years, and his purpose there from 1934 to 35 was to teach the Germans how to circumvent the Versailles Treaty, to secretly arm Germany. And this similarity between the Fritz Kramer on the National Security Council now and the Fritz Kramer that was in Germany, I think maybe you can see the resemblance, because our National Security Council has given orders to people like General Secord, who left the Air Force and then joined the Defense Intelligence Agency as an unsalaried consultant. He was to bypass the State Department, bypass the CIA, bypass the Pentagon and the existing Congress, and to go ahead and arm Iran or arm the Contras, both of them illegal. There were congressional orders and bills passed that they were not to arm the Contras or to send weapons to Khomeini. But the Fritz Kramer that was in Germany was teaching how to circumvent the Versailles Treaty, and the Fritz Kramer that sits on the National Security Council was working with the powers that be to circumvent the existing institutions, again, these parallel governments. Now, James Weingartner refers to Kramer as a military intellectual of the type that characterized the Prussian General Staff Corps. And when war began, he was part of the 13th Panzer Division and was awarded the Knight's Cross, the Senior Quartermaster to 1st Panzer Corps. He got a lot of medals, and he switched to the Liebstandarte and the 13th Panzer, then the SS Panzer with Sepp Dietrich, and the Waffen-SS borrowed Kramer, and he became a member of the Waffen-SS. He was, in fact, a member of the Waffen-SS and was part of the 1st Panzer Division. But always the person who is the intellectual, he may not have actually been in any of these battles at all. And he was appointed chief of staff of the 6th Panzer Division at the Ardennes Offensive. But the point is that his expertise was not in fighting. There's no record of him in any battle at all or any location of a battle. But his expertise was how to get around the existing laws and training the private companies and the Freikorps, who looked independent but were part of the military, the death squads that were operating and knocking out the liberals or the radicals or the resistance, and then having a grand election in 1933, and then Murder Incorporated became legal. We have those parallels now, and the point is that Both of these men, Wiedemeyer and Kramer, attended this Berlin War Academy, the Kriegsakademie, and weren't many years apart. Weingarten describes Kramer as an entirely different category than the other Germans because information on his past isn't available, as I say, and he was a member of the Waffen-SS. Now, Weingarten says he was there not of his own volition. How would he know he's not of his own volition? This Kramer left, the American Kramer that was the mentor to Henry Kissinger, left his wife and child in Nazi Germany by his own choice during the war. I will do more on the Weingarten book and his interpretation of Kramer later, but the importance of Project Paperclip I emphasized just not too many weeks ago, a quotation that was in Nation magazine, August 1986, where Walter Dornberger, that same person that came over on Project Paperclip, said that he didn't come to this country to lose the Third World War. I lost two, and I don't want to lose the third. So that the activity or interest in the paperclip scientists that could lead us to the Third World War is very important, and it's interesting that a retired military in charge of the desk of the news department at the Monterey Herald left out the Project Paperclip. You wonder how many people really know about these things and don't give any indication of why they selectively take that material and not want the people to read it. The problem with escalating war is, as we get into another one and they plan the fourth one, is that a lot of people know that these plans are in the offing, but they don't want those people who suffer the most or pay for the war to know. They're actually the last to know. The Trilateral Commission is having their meeting in San Francisco. Those of you who get these broadcasts, it will be over. It'll only be over in terms of the physical meeting. The pressure of the meeting will be over us for a long, long time. They're meeting in San Francisco this week. Henry Kissinger is the main speaker. He's traveling with David Rockefeller and National Security Advisor Frank Carlucci. Those will be among the main speakers. And Kissinger will give a half-hour talk called After Rekovich, which is really shocking, and After Rekovich will be given in private, and if past practice is followed, the text might be available for the press. I hope it will be. It's interesting that I fingered Fritz Kramer and Henry Kissinger as top in the United States, a hierarchy of this manipulation that's going on, and I also have identified Rekovich as the beginning and the end of the Ronald Reagan presidency. That when Nicholas Danilov was arrested in Russia, I believe this was a setup. And after that event, when the Russians were forced to release them, the conditions were, we'll meet at Rekovich. Ronald Reagan wasn't prepared to meet there. And the disaster of that began to show how the president was toppling and not in control of matters. There's an article in the LA Herald, March the 6th, a syndicated column by William Sapphire on a polygraph test given to Robert McFarlane. And he allegedly failed the test, and it was printed by Philip Taubman of the New York Times, and it was an exclusive story saying U.S. aides say British spy gave Soviet key data. And this is a article citing an American sources that Philip Taubman wrote about, and about the British government and a serious leak that went on to the Russians. And allegedly there was a lie detector test given, and Robert McFarlane was the person who was supposed to have given the leak, and he didn't pass the test. And then the pressure was put on the powers that be to get the New York Times to say who did the leaking to the newspaper, because McFarlane was certified as a non-leaker. He was staying in the White House staff. He was promoted a year later to National Security Advisor. And the polygraph testers just explained that they almost had to terminate their career and they couldn't get reliable results by questioning about leaks from other officials. Later, it was admitted that by Mr. Taubman that it wasn't McFarlane that gave the leak. But the important part about shuffling up the National Security Council, giving polygraph tests to join Poindexter or to their secretaries and so forth, is that Philip Taubman was the gentleman behind that. He printed it October 24th, 1982. And Philip Taubman was the gentleman who was working with Mrs. Danilov and who she was in contact with when Danilov gave a package with some messages to a fellow, and Danilov was picked up and arrested. and the American embassy wasn't informed, and the Soviet Union had called Mrs. Danloff, but the arrangements as an agent provocateur situation that brought Ronald Reagan out in the open as being less than in control of himself and exposed to secret dealings really began with the Taubman-Danloff relationship. And you'd have to go back to my other Danloff tapes. I did 2 hours on that alone to understand it. But this material comes out just at the time that the trilateral meeting. And I believe there's a setup by this group, Mr. Carlucci, David Rockefeller, and Henry Kissinger and Alexander Haig, identical to the time when the tape was left on the door at the Watergate Hotel. Now, the San Francisco Chronicle had a very brief item the other day. Behind the Tower report, Brent Scowcroft, this is General Scowcroft, the most obscure member of the Tower Commission, is fingered by insiders as the real force behind the scathing report on the White House blunders of the Iran-Contra affair. It was General Scowcroft, not retired Senator John Tower or one-time presidential candidate Secretary of State Edmund Muskie, who knew from his duty at the White House National Security as advisor where the skeletons might be buried. Now, Brent Scowcroft is on the board and chairman of Kissinger Associates. So just as the Scotch tape brought somebody up to the offices of the Democratic headquarters, Scowcroft could go immediately to the place where information was kept that would be putting this administration on the defensive for the next 100 years. Another article came out in the Washington Post February 28th. Computer detective found crucial data. Interns' high-tech sleuthing led to the files. And it tells about a 4-foot stack of internal NSC messages coaxed from a White House computer's memory bank by a 26-year-old staff member of the Tower Review Board played a key role in the week's blockbuster report on secret dealings in the Iran-Contra affair. It was a real mother lode, they explained. The messages opened up that were discovered by Kenneth J. Krieg, K-R-E-I-G, opened up those stories that started the flow of information out about Ronald Reagan's affairs. The Washington Post said it was something only a young person could do. And you see, another article says that Scowcroft knew how to go there and what to go for. The young people like Oliver North and young technologists such as Mr. Krieg are blamed or praised, whichever you see it, for knowing where to find those hidden bodies or keys or doors that are open, in this case, computer technology. But on the other hand, Krieg had tips from General Scowcroft on where to go, and then everything else started tumbling down. All this computer technology baffles me, said John Tower. Other sources said Krieg, a 1985 graduate of Harvard University's John Kennedy School of Government, may have known what to demand because he previously had been assigned temporarily to the NSC's Crisis Management Center. Now, the Crisis Management Center was also joined by Fritz Kramer, who was on the board and part of the Crisis Management Center. He's also on the NSC, and his son, Sven Kramer, is on the NSC. So all you had to know is be part of the Crisis Management Center, and you know where to go for the inter-office profs, P-R-O-F-S. Those are the messages sent through the inner offices. And I've watched the similarities between this and Watergate and who stays behind the scenes. And, of course, it's Kissinger and Haig who come out looking squeaky clean, and General Scowcroft could get this information. And, as I say, the others then were forced to roll on it. They covered up a lot, but they got enough out to bring this administration down, but not enough to end the National Security Council, as John Tower and the others said. The National Security Council will stay as is. We'll just deal with individuals. They also said the Contra diversion is a black hole out there with some money in it, but John Tower knows where that money is. Now, Alexander Haig was on television the very week that the Contragate story broke of the connection of Iran to Nicaragua, the funds to Nicaragua. And he was interviewed night after night for about 5 evenings, announcing he would be president of the United States. The Miami Herald had a story March the 4th, Haig critiquing Ronald Reagan. Misjudgments spark the crisis. Polishing of his image is not enough, he says. Former Secretary of State Alexander Haig said Tuesday that the Iran-Contra crisis resulted from Reagan's misjudging of foreign policies and was not the single aberration characterized in the Tower Report. He warned that in the effort to rehabilitate the Reagan image by seeking an arms control with the Soviets, America's long-term interests will be subverted. We can't use an issue of national security as a vehicle to get well politically, Haig said. He later said that he will announce publicly, which he's done already, that he wants to be the Republican nomination for president. Haig, in his first comment on the Iran-Contra crisis since the release last week of the Tower Report, questioned whether White House staffs, including Senator Howard Baker, his chief of staff, and the burnished image of the more engaged Ronald Reagan, will be sufficient to stem the crisis. One thing is clear, all the talk about changing the president's image now from a hands-off to a hands-on president is just not going to do the job, Haig said. There's no longer a question of imagery. It is a problem of substance. And see, Haig knows that there's no substance there, so all you have to do is leak the tapes and computer disks that tell you where things went wrong. Things have gone wrong constantly, but these people stay on top, and now they're hammering or putting salt in the wound by tearing apart Rekovich, tearing apart the president, as Haig and Carlucci and Henry Kissinger travel around, participate in the trilateral meeting with David Rockefeller. It was after Watergate that Nelson Rockefeller became vice president, appointed by Gerry Ford. Nothing in the Constitution makes way for that. And now David Rockefeller, of course, is the head, the titular head of the whole trilateral, and he's out there with Carlucci and Kissinger, and they're enjoying thoroughly the demise of the Ronald Reagan administration. Or maybe it's a Rockefeller vengeance for his brothers being deep sixed in order for Ronald Reagan to become president. They let him be president, and now they're going a little farther. The article in the Miami paper says, Haig viewed the Tower Commission's report from a unique perspective because as an Army officer in 1969, he was assigned to the National Security Staff as an aide to then-National Security Advisor Henry Kissinger. Haig sat on the board. Haig was promoted to NSC chief under Richard Nixon, and in the final 2 years of the Nixon presidency, when a number of White House aides were being tainted by the Watergate scandal, Haig was brought in as chief of staff. He's ready for that job again, even though Mr. Baker is taking it temporarily. Haig this time wants to go for president. He's wanted for a long time. After an unsuccessful run for president in 1980, he was Secretary of State the first 18 months of the Reagan administration. So Alexander Haig is giving wire service interviews and news that your image isn't enough, that your arms control isn't going to work, you're weak, your staff is weak, and Henry Kissinger will talk 30 minutes about Rekovich, what he would have done, what the president did wrong at Rekovich, and what I, the great Henry, did, we should do again. And as the investigations go on in Washington, there's agreement between the House, the Senate, and the other offices that there will be moles between the Senate and the House, and that they will share information, that there'll be no surprises, and so forth. Jack Anderson had an article just this morning, Purge at the CIA, and it tells how when Ronald Reagan came in 1980, he had a secret hit list of 26 to be purged, and among what Jack Anderson calls the leftists is Frank Carlucci. Carlucci helped. Just think of one term of leftists. He helped Vernon Walters, Knight of Malta, CIA, DIA, to overthrow Brazil in 1964, and it took 22 years to get out from under the military dictatorship, and the night before the first democratically elected president is to take office, he gets sick, poisoned, goes through four or five surgeries that I did many broadcasts on, and dies. Mr. Tancredo Neves and Mr. Sarney comes in after him. So if you think he's a liberal, Jack Anderson calls Carlucci a liberal, and he said that Carlucci left the CIA when Reagan came in, but he went to the Defense Department. He not only went to the Defense Department, but he picked along the way Eric von Marburg, the partner of Edwin Wilson and Frank Turpel, and Theodore Shackley and Thomas Kleins, and the whole Contragate Iran team that had been in place for a long time, and worked his way back to become the chief of staff of the White House, of the National Security, rather, not the White House, and attends the Trilateral Commission with David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, And Haig, of course, trailing right with him. And Zbigniew Brzezinski is a part of the trilateral. Fritz Kramer is sitting on the National Security Council. I've done so many broadcasts on these people, but I want to repeat it until the vision of the power and the way the power stays in becomes really strong in your minds. And there's always new listeners to pick this up. I'll take a one-minute break now, and then I just want to briefly discuss a book, The Agency, The Rise and Decline of the CIA, from Wild Bill Donovan to William Casey, and discuss that with you. It's published by John Ranelli, Simon & Schuster. It just came out this past year, and it tells you the role of Kissinger and his team taking power from the CIA and putting it into the National Security Council.